Hey everyone, it's me, Amy Walter. Before we start the conversation, I wanted to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by the Cook Political Report. If you're interested in more of our great content, consider signing up for our free newsletter, In Brief. Look for the link in our show notes. Hello, welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. You may know my guest today, Josh Holmes, as one of the hosts of the popular political podcast, Ruthless. Now, for those of you who don't know, Ruthless is to the conservative media sphere as Pod Save America is to the liberal media ecosystem. But long before he started his podcasting gig, I knew Josh as a Republican political operative. He was chief of staff to Mitch McConnell, ran his 2014 reelect. He also had a stint at the National Republican Senate Committee. He now runs the public affairs firm Cavalry, and he's still actively giving advice to Republican candidates. Josh's two roles as a member of the new media and a seasoned Republican political hand gives him unique perspective into our current political era. Our conversation spans a similar gamut, from what advice he'd give to down-ballot Republicans for the upcoming midterms to his thoughts on the Trump tariff endgame, as well as how candidates can best navigate the new media landscape. We recorded this conversation on Wednesday, May 7th. Here's Josh. Josh Holmes, thank you so much for joining me. Really happy to have you.
Oh, so happy to be here, Amy. We've worked together on many things over the years. It's great to have some time to talk about the world.
You sort of teed me up perfectly, and this was the very first question I was going to bring up to you, is that a lot of folks may only know you as the Ruthless podcast guy, but I have known you for a very long time.
That's right.
And when I think of Josh, I think of Republican operative Josh. I think of Senate Republican guy, yeah. Josh. So I want you to put that hat on for a minute.
Yeah, I still wear it.
I know you still wear it. I know you still wear it. But, you know, it's hard. You got to balance it with being a podcast star. your job, let's pretend today you're now over at the RNC or the NRSC, the NRCC, right? You're running one of those operations, mm-hmm. and you're talking to your staff and you're talking to members. What do you tell them about the midterms? How are you preparing them for this? How should they be thinking about it?
Well, I think you start with a premise that, you know, in the Trump era of politics, presidential elections have been pretty good for turnout. It's a changed universe of yep. potential voters where you've got basically a swap out, almost a person for person swap out of what used to be a suburban base with a rural and exurban base, largely in the center of the country. And during presidential elections, it works out great for you. And in midterms, not so much. And if you think about part of the reason for that is there's probably within a suburban base, you've got somewhere between 73-78% turnout in a midterm, which is great. And they turn out in the presidentials and everything else. But when you swap that out for a more rural exurban demographic, you're talking about 57. And so, you know, much of the success the Republicans had in midterms in 2010, 2014, you relied a lot on those economically facing suburban voters that turned out at a high rate, and Republicans overperformed in midterms. And that's a changed dynamic in this environment. And so I would spend an awful lot of time figuring out how you can mobilize that new base in a midterm that we haven't done in 18, 22. And, you know, maybe 26 is the year.
Yeah. You know, Josh, it's not much different than what Democrats had to deal with in the era of Obama, right?
Exactly.
They said, oh, we're just going to turn out the Obama coalition.
Right.
And guess who the Obama coalition turned out for? Yeah. Obama. Yeah. And the Trump coalition turns out for Trump.
Yeah.
But it raises sort of a bigger question, though, Josh, because even in the Bush era, the Obama era, et cetera, you know, you're right. You saw these sort of roller coasters between presidential turnout and midterms and results from both of those elections. But there was always a sense that, you know, 2 years, 4 years later, there's going to be a new person as the head of the party, and the coalition would change and evolve mm-hmm. with them. But now it feels as if, and I really want to get your opinion on this, the Republican Party is so tied to the image of Donald Trump that when there's no more Donald Trump, how does the party identify itself?
I mean, it's a really good question. And I think there's a lot of people that would come to the conclusion that you just articulated, that you are so identified at this point with MAGA, with Trump, that any other image whatsoever would be extremely difficult to attain. I come at this from a little different perspective. Maybe it's, I don't know, you do this for 25 years and you've seen four different iterations of the Republican
yeah.
Party.
Yeah.
But then even backing that off and looking historically, you know, through Reagan, Nixon, you know, you can go back to Eisenhower. I mean, I've always had a theory that in Republican politics, it's almost impossible to get the nomination surfing a wave that is built by a previous president or a previous movement. You almost always have to capture the imagination of the electorate in a way that gives them something else and something different to think about. I mean, the only exception to that whatsoever, I would argue, is not an exception with George H.W. Bush, when, you know, 1,000 points of light looks an awful lot different than a shining city on the hill. And there was a messaging distinction between Ronald Reagan and H.W. Bush. They made two very separate candidates, despite the fact that one was a vice president for the other. So, you know, historically speaking, the Republican Party has evolved with a lot of frequency. And if you just look at the last 20 years, I mean, this Republican Party is unrecognizable from the one that you had in the beginning of the decade or beginning of the century here with George H.W. Bush and War on Terror and compassionate conservatism and all the rest.
Yeah, though, Josh, there was this, again, when we were growing up in politics, there was this line of Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line.
That's changed.
And, you know, there's the person who's mm-hmm. Bob Dole. It was his turn, right? And yeah. It was Mitt Romney's turn because, right, this was the right guy in the right place versus the passions of the electorate. And I think Trump really did turn that on its head. And now it's Democrats who seem to be doing the it's time mm-hmm. to fall in line, which they did with Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And Republicans are like, we're not buying what you're selling, traditional Republican politician. You got to repackage and rebrand.
Yeah. Well, I think there's, I mean, look, Trump has ushered in a new level of authenticity in politics across the board. And I think anybody who's just happened to be in line who reads you their talking points on a day-to-day basis isn't going to get very high up that hierarchy of consideration for voters. And so everything has to have a level of authenticity. But I really do think, you know, whatever happens post-Trump, it is going to be very, very difficult for somebody to just sort of sit on top of it and
yeah.
claim the mantle of MAGA and sort of pretend like they are an heir apparent to a movement that they did not build.
I think
environments change, political parties change, economy changes, so many different things, you know, and not to mention external events, you know, things like 9/11, the financial crisis, COVID. You get a different brand of both political parties that reflect unforeseen events. And I just think that we're constantly evolving and changing. I mean, it's one of the things I love about politics.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
You got to figure this stuff out and then get to the root of what the concerns are of voters across the country, both in terms of a primary electorate and a general electorate.
Yep. Yep. Well, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. We haven't even had the midterms, but
yeah.
So I do want to, and you, again, you've been through a lot of these midterm type of elections before, and, you know, Just again, if thinking about, okay, what would it take to turn out either the Trump base or at least to keep, I guess there are two questions. One is there's the sort of traditional Trump base, and then there are the new people that have become part of the base, right? Mm-hmm. You talked about rural and exurban, but in 2024, we saw younger voters, we
yep.
saw urban voters of color, and most specifically, we saw independent voters move over to Trump.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a very different coalition than one that again, Republicans have been used to working with.
Yeah, I think that the Hispanic, I think the growth within the party in Hispanic and particularly multi-generational Hispanic communities has been a work in progress that has shown real results over a period of time. Obviously, that has come to fruition in a different way under President Trump. But you think about sort of the alignment of party priorities, not just with President Trump, but some more, you know, sort of traditional Republican points of view. It seems like a fit that you could build upon year after year. When you're talking about other communities, you know, Trump, frankly, might just be the guy that can do what other people can't. And I think the trick in a midterm is to try to distinguish between the two. And you've got to ratchet down very specifically to what districts and states are we going for here. This is not a national movement. This is very specific to what it is that build majorities in 2026. And then you take a look at those populations and try to figure out, you know, how many different ways you can skin a cat. Because, you know, one way we always approach these things was if everything goes wrong, if you have a bad economy, if you've got, you know, things that you cannot control that sour and dampen the mood of the Republican Party, what are the three or four different pathways that can still get you home? And those are the off-year things. You know, those are the things that you spend an awful lot. I tell you, every single time it comes back to one single starting point, and it's candidate quality. And you've got to make sure that you've got a candidate that can not only articulate a vision that resonates with a state or district, but somebody who's tested enough not to fold and can continue to do that with huge high-pressure situations where there's no presidential candidate that blocks out the sun, right? You're on the front line of this deal. And when, you know, the New York Times shows up at your doorstep, they want to talk to you, not everything else. So yeah, candidate quality is where it starts. Then you do a big demographic push. You try to figure out all the various pathways you can get home.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of those candidates because, Josh, again, if you were over in your old job over at the NRSC and you see Brian Kemp saying no to a run in Georgia, which that is a great pickup opportunity for Republicans there. You had Sununu, another popular former governor, saying no in New Hampshire. What do you think this tells us about the mood right now among potentially really good candidates and how recruiting could line up for this next year?
Well, look, let me start by saying I'm really hesitant to be critical of anybody. I mean, this was my job for 15 years, right? And so, you know, Senate Republicans in particular have got a very unique circumstance in that this is the first real turnover that they've had since 2007 in the campaign apparatus and how it's operated. And there was a lot of lessons learned from us before we got to a point where we're consistently winning Senate races and majorities and everything else. And so, you know, some of these lessons have to be learned the hard way. And there's no absolute right way to do things. But I always thought that the most important thing in an election, you can talk about the money, it's very, very important, but you also can build in various plans to do that in an election year where you are comparable, as long as you're laying the infrastructure correctly. What you can't do is restart party alignment in the on year. Like, you've got to start in the off year. And that goes with finding all the opportunities and then making sure that you've got alignment with leaders within the Republican Party, the White House, local leaders about candidates, and trying to disarm a bomb that is a potential primary that could take valuable resources out of a general election, and try to do that as quickly as you possibly can. So you've got, you know, by the end of the summer of the off year, you've got at least the makings of a slate of three or four really good opportunities that you know you're going to be able to rely on when, you know, all hell comes raining down the next year. I don't think they're there yet. And I think part of that is you've got a new administration that has an awful lot to do on their agenda, both foreign and domestic, and a Congress with very thin majorities that is trying their very best to try to figure out how to do the official side duties. And so the politics right after you win an election don't seem like a top priority. I think what I learned in doing it is it has to be. You've got to figure that stuff out. And, you know, if you look at like Texas, that's a real disappointment. That to me is something that could have been avoided with Senator Cornyn having a potential primary there.
The disappointment being that there's a primary against a sitting incumbent.
Feels like a bomb.
Ken Paxton taking on Cornyn. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like a bomb that should have been disarmed before we got there. You know, I'm not saying that it is not going to be. It just gets more difficult after people file paperwork. Kemp is sort of a unique situation in that he's a unicorn and he knows it. Is the guy who's an incredible, sophisticated political operator who's not in love with tying their own political fortunes to things that they cannot control. So that was always going to be a tough recruitment process. I think it was made more difficult by economic environments and all kinds of, highlighting what his core concern would be, and that I don't have my hands on the wheel of ultimately how people perceive the environment or my candidacy. And so, you know, look, things could change. I've seen cycles where you get into a fall and somebody completely changes their mind.
Marco Rubio, right? Remember?
Yeah.
He said, I'm not running, and then jumped in again at the last minute. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there were several that we just kept working on. I mean, Cory Gardner in Colorado said no publicly about three times before we ultimately got him into that race in 2014, which is a real game changer. It allowed us to spread the map and have the capacity of winning double digit Senate seats, which is not typically done on the Republican side. So I don't know if that's a done deal or not. Clearly you would have loved to have had Kemp. We'll see. Georgia's still got to be a huge pickup opportunity. Republicans need to focus on that. But there are all of these things that feel like they need to be sewed up, right? And they can only be sewed up with alignment within the party. The good news for Republicans is it's an awful lot easier to do that in a shorter timetable when you have the White House than when you don't. I mean, my entryway into politics, Amy, was in 2002 when then Vice President Cheney called Tim Pawlenty and told him, you're not running for Senate, you're running for governor.
I remember that.
Norm Coleman, the vice versa. And, you know, that was my first campaign. But that's what the White House has the capability of doing, knowing that there's huge amounts of political SWAT that is associated with it, that can clean things up a little quick. So I don't think this is not a problem that is existential at this point, but they're going to have to make some progress on that.
Right. I mean, the thing to me in Georgia, Josh, is it's one thing for Brian Kemp to say no. It's another thing for, say, Donald Trump to endorse Marjorie Taylor Greene, right?
Yeah. I mean, this bedeviled Senate races in particular. Senate races for, you know, unless you do this for a living, it's hard to communicate how different they are than House races, governor's races, or anything on the state and local level. They're miniature presidential campaigns.
Yeah.
I mean, people get to know these people inside and out. I mean, every flaw, every asset. I mean, there is $100 million being spent in your state if you have anything remotely competitive. And so you've got to have a tested candidate. You got to have somebody. And you've seen, you know, circumstances where we have 22 is the latest, midterm, where you've got candidates that couldn't get it done.
A quick break, and we'll be back with Josh Holmes. It might be a political odd year, but here at the Cook Political Report, we're as busy as ever. Over the last few weeks, we've rolled out our race ratings for governors, the House, and the Senate. It's not too early to think about next year's midterms, and we have everything you need to know about these races. But it's only available to Cook Political Report subscribers. So don't wait. Join us. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. I'm going to shift over to Trump and specifically the tariff stuff. And I know you guys have talked about this on your own podcast a bit, sort of trying to walk through what's going on here. And, you know, it just seems to me at a very basic level, you have a president who really likes tariffs and what they could do, and a public that's like, No, we really don't. So how does this thing end?
Well, I think you need a little bit of a decoder ring because you get multiple messages within the White House itself.
Yeah. Is that the bigger problem, the multiple messages, or is it that, because what I'm seeing in polling, and I've seen it back for a while, long before Trump started the Liberation Day, is that voters have been somewhat skeptical about this from the very beginning, right? Like they see tariffs, they're pretty sophisticated. They see tariffs as something that's going to raise costs for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, look, it starts with the bipolar definition of what we're doing here. And then you've got like a Peter Navarro crowd who says tariffs are good. They make us money. They have domestic job building capability and all that. And then you've got the Bessent side that, you know, believes it is a tool that the president can use to get a better deal. Now, assuming it's the latter, and this is my theory of the case, assuming it's the latter, that it is in fact a tool, and there's some indication that that is the case, I think what you get with President Trump is somebody who has an external message that he sends to the American people, but he also has to hold in abeyance this negotiation with the international community. And the last thing anybody's ever negotiated anything, last thing you want to do is communicate how badly you need a deal, which I think is what he's doing at some level. You saw the press conference yesterday where he was talking about, I could sign 25 deals today. And it has to be on our terms. They need it more than I do. Well, that's a leverage play, right? Anybody who's read The Art of the Deal or understands Donald Trump at all, that's a leverage play. He wants to communicate that he doesn't need this as badly as you do, so you better give me a pretty good deal. I fundamentally don't believe that they think that this is a sustainable strategy to not have deals. I think they've seen the economic impact immediately. I think that you have huge swaths of the Trump coalition, ag, energy, center of the country stuff, not to mention the newfound support from the tech side that he's getting, that had to take a real bath. And over a long period of time becomes unsustainable because you've got an international community that starts to look for different solutions that don't include the United States. So I think they know that they've got to get deals. I would be surprised if in the next week to 10 days, you don't start to see the formation of two or three of these, India is one that's been talked about, but others, where they start rolling that out as a part of kind of the roll up to reconciliation, a tax deal. And if that's a slow build here through the late spring, early summer, and you get both sort of squared away by Labor Day of next year, you could have a fundamentally different and roaring economy. I think that's what they're trying to do. Now, it's up for everybody else's interpretation because I'm listening to the same thing you all are. But that's my sense of where things are at.
Yeah, I was talking to one Republican who said, I wish what Trump would do is give like an Oval Office address kind of deal of,
explain it.
Hey, you guys, here's what we're doing and here's why we're doing it. You can still do Art of the Deal, but talk about it and then really focus it on China. Make this more about China than anything else where voters may be more willing to do that. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I just think it all comes back to how he negotiates absolutely everything. And there, it hasn't just been in the trade context. It's been virtually everything since he's been on the political stage, is that he's got a top line message that he gives you about making America great. But then some of the external comments that you get are all about him leveraging different pieces of the puzzle to ultimately what he wants to accomplish. I think that's where he's at right now. The China thing is obviously much more complicated. Much more difficult to untangle. And you get the feeling from somebody like President Xi of China that he'd rather take his economy down to the studs than provide any leverage to the United States. Now, they've got a meeting next weekend, I guess, where there is some de-escalation talk. I don't think we're going to get a trade deal out of it, but perhaps we can have something short of an embargo, which is basically what it is right now, that will help sort of do that. But much more importantly to me are these Asian countries, India, EU, making sure that our friends and allies still have an open and willing trade partner with us to sort of isolate China in many ways. Because if, no, look, if the EU's got a big economy, not nearly as big as ours, but if it can't do business with the United States, it's going to do business with somebody. And if they get into a point where you're starting to entertain a real trade relationship with China out of necessity, that makes this whole discussion much, much more difficult.
Yeah, and I guess that's a question, too, of how much the American public is going to hold on, right? The idea of President Trump continuing to counsel patience and then talking about you don't need $15 or $28 or whatever the number was. And I like this theory from Liam Donovan, you know, Liam, another Republican strategist coming from your same mold. He says, the challenge for Trump in selling tariffs is that at best it means counseling patience, sacrifice, and delayed gratification, which runs counter to his entire political ethos, right? Yeah. The guy who says like, boom, 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 we're making America great today is saying, whoa, 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 you got to wait. And that seems like for a lot of voters, whether you voted for Donald Trump or not, they're going, whoa, I didn't think we were going to have to wait for this. And I didn't think I was going to have to counsel my kids on Christmas about the stuff that's not coming from China.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, there's always political peril in the Jimmy Carter turn down the heat and put on a sweater message, right? Nobody wants that. I think the most difficult thing to do in today's politics is try to have a longer time horizon on how you ultimately come to conclusions. This has been true of President Trump literally since he came down the golden escalator. There's a whole bunch of assumptions that are built in on a day-to-day basis as if you live in an entirely static political world, when in reality, it's very dynamic. I mean, we could literally be sitting here a year from now and laugh about what a moment in time these 30 days from Liberation Day in April through May was in the grand scheme of things. And so that's the most difficult part to sort of prognosticate in the political sense is this a moment in time? Or is this a fundamental problem that's going to run all the way through the summer into next year that will take time, even in the best circumstances, to sort of recover and get the American people optimistic again?
That's right. That's right. And when you were thinking, again, thinking through the lens of an operative, thinking through the lens of a campaign manager, let's say we do get, it's now 2026, we're getting into the spring of 2026, the optimism, not bouncing back. How do you run both as a member of the Republican Party and an ally of Donald Trump, but also separate yourself from the bad stuff? How can you do that?
Yeah, it's called a good personality. It's something that's been sorely lacking in politics, maybe my whole life. But there are people like Glenn Youngkin, obviously, who famously did it in Virginia. There's no question in the era of Trump, there is going to have to be some adhesion to the Trump universe, the president himself. That relationship needs to be good. It just does. You can't go pick a fight with the president.
Right. You can't go in and say, I'm going to be the, as a Republican, say, I'm going to just separate myself from Trump.
Yeah.
And that's how I'm going to win re-election, is because I'm going to say, that's all Trump's problem. I'm here fighting a different fight.
Yeah. If you look at the people who have tried that from 2016 on, it has always ended in tears. But if you got a good personality and you have a good ideological fit with your state and you actually have an infrastructure where you know people and you take the time to hit the ground as well as whatever it is you're doing on TV and advertising and everything else, there's a capability of getting people to the point where they know you're part of this Trump coalition, but you're relatable in a way that maybe pieces of it are not. And there are quality candidates who have done that very, very successfully over the years that are a little bit different, right? I mean, Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania is a really good example of that, right? Good friend of this administration. Also, super deep and thoughtful and sophisticated on economic issues, talks about it a lot. And has just sort of a more relatable, particularly with that like Philadelphia suburb class and Delaware County and Chester County and all those places that have not gone for President Trump, but were old school sort of locked down Republican voters at one point. And so that's the challenge, is to try to fit these things together in a midterm that gives you the best chance to get to 50 plus one, knowing also what's the art of the possible. You don't want to go try to push a boulder up a hill by saying, I'm going to turn out the Trump coalition in these rural counties that have had a historical rate of 50, 56, 57% in a midterm and spend all of your resources doing that, when you have a capability of people who are turning out no matter what at 78,
right,
trying to figure out whether or not you can even the score,
yep,
on that crew, right? So those are all the kind of the pieces that go into it.
Oh, I know. And as I, you know, I'm a house person. I like you Senate people, you're fine. But
we haven't turned it into the Senate's kitchen quite yet.
You know, look, we saw, especially in 2020, that specific House candidates were able to hold on even as the district was moving away from Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it was hard to make them into a mini Trump, right? People just didn't buy it.
Yeah.
And the question now is, if you're in the, you know, it's you're in the majority now, right? You are in charge of the House and the Senate and the White House. And so you take a lot more responsibility, which gets to the next question, speaking of the House and Senate, which is this big tax bill and reconciliation. Again, you've been through these before in your lifetime. To me, it's not surprising that we're seeing a bumpy road. It always goes like this. Whether you have a 40-seat majority or a 3-seat majority, it is bumpy and messy, and it stops and it starts, and it's never going to happen, and it's definitely going to happen. So my question to you is a little broader than that, which is, look, you talk to Democrats, you know this, they are feeling incredibly confident that between the anxiety about tariffs and the economy, plus a tax bill that they're pretty much telegraphing what the attacks are going to be. You cut healthcare for vulnerable people to pay for tax cuts for Elon Musk, right? Mm-hmm. How do Republicans, what do they ultimately do? What are they able to get? And then how do they message that in a way that allows them to not get branded as the Medicaid cutters who are destroying America's economy?
Yeah, well, look, I think one of the things that Republicans have going for them is they have actually proof of concept when it comes to tax cuts.
You mean that voters already give them some credibility on that?
Well, they give them credibility in large part because of the result. And, you know, when you look back at what some of the things that Democrats have done, the big agenda items that were in the first part of the Biden administration, where they were talking about the Inflation Reduction Act or the sort of quote unquote stimulus type stuff that they were doing with COVID, there was never a real tangible feel that anything got a lot better. And in converse, I mean, with inflation and everything else, things got a lot worse. But if you look at just the recent history of tax cuts, right, 01. It worked. It was a significant tax cut. And 02, people felt like the economy was coming out of 9/11 and everything else and starting to roar. Passed it again in 03, another set of tax cuts. Well, 04, people rewarded him with that. Obviously, it got more complicated with the Iraq war and everything else. But Bush was reelected in large part because people felt like the economy was doing well and they didn't want to go in a different direction. 17 is another really good example of where the economy ultimately went up until obviously COVID in 2020 changed all of that, which, you know, changed the political universe and how we look at that particular election. So the point is that what they're doing from a policy perspective, I think there's great confidence under the dome will produce the kind of economic result that you can campaign on. You can message these things to death in terms of tax cuts for the wealth. I mean, since I've been born, every tax cut is characterized as a tax cut for the wealthy by the Democrats. It does have some effect, no question about it, but it changes really quickly when all of a sudden people feel like they've got more economic chances, that there's wealth creation in their community and in their home and things like that. And so I think that confidence is there from the Republican side that they can go out and do that. They're not as worried about the day-to-day messaging that it takes to actually get this thing across the finish line in a legislative capacity. So I think it works for them. Now, it gets more complicated when you do things like healthcare and everything else.
Right, because on healthcare, Democrats have just a generic advantage.
They do.
On who do you trust on this issue? And so if Democrats are able to make this a healthcare election.
Yeah, they've done pretty well. Everything other than 2014 has been pretty good for them in terms of a healthcare election. But I look, ultimately President Trump's entire political profile and that of the Republican Party over the next 2 years is going to be governed entirely by the perception of the economy, right? What he did with immigration, which was a huge center-right, center-left issue for the first time in my lifetime in the 24 election, is largely in the accomplishment bucket. I mean, people feel like he said what he was going to do and he's sort of done it. It's not going to rise back up into that top tier of a midterm election in any meaningful way. But what they also hired and maybe actually pushed him over the top on was this distinction between his management of the economy and your personal pocketbook in contrast with what Democrats and Biden were doing. That's the whole ball game here, Amy. And I think that flashes back to our tariff and tax discussion about why it's so important.
I'm going to shift gears here for the end of this interview to talk about what you're doing now and the whole podcast world, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean to you? Like, how do you see the role of something like Ruthless in the broader media landscape?
We were always in PR, political communications. It was always a component of what we had done with McConnell and campaigns and all these other pieces. But we noticed a significant shift in terms of how people were consuming news and information. And you could see it in ad resonance when you were doing ads during the course of an election. People were just not getting the same amount of movement out of what you saw on TV or what you read in your newspapers. Yep. And this longer form discussion piece started to creep in a meaningful way in terms of interviews and sort of the second stage of information. But I think the biggest piece of it, as it has grown and become more prolific, is people choose. I mean, if you're going to spend an hour listening to something, it's not background music. Like, you're actually listening to it. And rather than fight all day as a political professional to try to get the fifth paragraph quote in a story that's otherwise meaningless to a voter, it's all about the audience that's consuming all of those things. And like we noticed in the Republican side, there was a real hole of people who had a lighthearted approach to all of this, that had some cynicism, but also could just make fun of things and laugh about it and have a good time while you're trying to provide meaningful information, which is why we started Ruthless. But I mean, honestly, it was like a USB mic in the side of a computer. We had absolutely no idea that it would become what it's become. But I think as you saw this in the 24 election and President Trump's willingness to go out and make this a big part of his communication strategy, you saw the dividends start to play out in that there were audiences that just aren't reached through traditional means. They're not sitting there on their TV, and even digital advertising was difficult to reach an awful lot of people, but they could choose a couple of times a week to have content from people that they trusted and enjoyed and thought were entertaining. And he showed up there. And I think that was sort of the first external sign of what we had long suspected in our little shop, is a real change in news and information and how people were consuming it.
I mean, do you see, like, is your competitor Fox or is your competitor other podcasts? Or do you even consider that you're in a, is there such thing as a competitive, what does competitive mean even in this environment?
Yeah, we see it totally differently in that our view, we've always kind of referred to, remember that old band, The Band?
Yeah.
Where almost every significant act of the late 60s and 70s wanted to play a set with the band and they would bring the band up and do it. Like, that's kind of how we see ourselves, and that we don't see ourselves as direct competitors with anybody else so much as it's growing the larger ecosystem. I mean, if you're already online, you're listening to a podcast, I don't care whether it's Ben Shapiro or Megyn Kelly or whatever, you're already in a place where you've expanded the ecosystem that we could take advantage of. And, you know, we feel like we're a part of that for other things that follow us, and some people are just getting started. So I don't see it at all as a competitor. And in terms of the television stuff with Fox, still a hugely important component to the conservative media lens. One that, you know, I'm on Fox two or three times a week. I think it's an incredibly important component. I think we're additional to that, right? I think this is a longer form conversation that you don't get by the confines that you have in TV, that adds to what people can know and understand about what you're trying to do politically, what a party looks like, and kind of break things down for your average consumer.
Well, if you, again, go into your old job running a Senate campaign, how do you counsel your candidate on how to interact with these things? Like, how much of your time as a candidate should be dedicated to going on, if you get the chance, to your local TV or talking to your local reporters versus, you know, I'm going to sit down for an hour with these guys in Washington, or I'm going to sit down for 20 minutes with 10 different podcasts?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first thing you look at is just the demo and the reach of all of the possible deals here. And you take local news, still an important part in a lot of communities with a certain age demographic, that if that's what you're targeting, you still probably do it. But I think you also have to understand what gets me further down the road in terms of what I'm trying to communicate. You know, the 6-second soundbite in an adversarial question in your local newspaper is not really value added in any meaningful way. I think there's been a lot of candidates that have chosen to have these longer form conversations where people actually get to know them and they can bring out some personality to it. Now, I would say, if you don't have authenticity.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you. Like, there's also the risk, right? Everyone sees the reward upside.
Huge risk.
But you can really screw these things up.
Yeah. I mean, that's like we always say on Ruthless. There's no wrong way to answer a question, but the audience gets immediately whether you're just making it up or reading talking points, because they know your style. They know they're now integrated with the hosts. They understand what a day-to-day is like. And so when somebody comes in and they can't really get a feel for that style, they're super unrelatable.
Yep.
And that is a risk that particularly for first-time candidates are trying to take a big leap here. Not all podcast opportunities are good ones. Like, you're going to have to work on it a little bit. And if it sounds weird, right, that you're, you know, we used to do all of this prep for TV interviews and that kind of thing. I think you got to do a little bit more prep for podcast stuff than you do for a TV hit, because
100%.
You know, they're going to find out who you are in that conversation.
Right. The expectations, if I'm watching you get interviewed by Bret Baier as a candidate, I kind of have a sense of how you're going to respond, right? And how you should in that milieu. But if you're on a podcast with you guys and you try to get this person to answer a question as a real person and they can't do that.
That's the problem. Yeah.
That then becomes a bigger mark against them, right? Because
it's more revealing than anything else.
It's more revealing. That's a great way to think of that. Yes.
Yeah. A bad answer is one thing. An answer that exposes inauthenticity and an unrelatability is potentially devastating.
Right.
Right. And also is a clue, if you're a good operative on the other side, it's a really good clue to what you should try to hone in on and some of the liabilities that you should start to try to draw out in the course of a campaign, because they just tell on themselves.
I was just talking to a member about this the other day who said, I love listening to these podcasts that, you know, my opponents are on, because they also say stuff that I'm like, I can't believe you just said that. And we're going to clip and save that.
Yeah.
Right? That's going to go in an ad.
Yeah. Although I do think, look, I think political professionals in a lot of ways still operate very much in a framework that was 10, 15 years ago. Mm. That is like a, look what they said, I'm going to clip it and be, you know, sort of come out and say, you know, this is, first of all, it's television advertising, right? So you can make an argument about how much that's going to move the needle one way or another. But second of all, I think people just in this particular moment in time really, really want authenticity. If you have an ability to have a sense of humor, if there's self-deprecation involved, if you can entertain difficult questions without being adversarial, like, all of those things are really important in today's world in a way that, honestly, Amy, it really wasn't.
Yeah.
I started in this line of work. It really wasn't. It was like, just set it in the typewriter. You know, if you can spit out exactly what I've written on this piece of paper, we're going to be good here. And I just don't think that works anymore.
Well, also the don't answer the question they give you, answer the question that you want to answer. And voters have picked up on that.
Yeah.
They go, wait a minute, This guy asked you a question and you are going all the way around here to not answer it.
Yeah.
And that advice is just totally meaningless today.
This is what this medium has provided and how it has changed politics, because you're right. I mean, what you ultimately want is to, you don't necessarily have to sit at the bar and have a beer with them, which is the old test in politics, but you got to be somebody that you can have in the living room without wanting to call the cops. You know what I mean? And like, there is, I understand those are two very polar differences, but you got to find yourself somewhere in there where you think you can have a meaningful conversation in a relatable way. Like, one of the things we've been laughing about a lot are all these President Trump interviews with all the network anchors where they're sitting there knee to knee in like these, you know, these chairs, and they're sitting there knee to knee, kind of like eyeball to eyeball, like the old Frost Nixon style deal. And it's like, what are you trying to do here? Like, what? No one in the world talks like that or sits like that. I mean, it just, it communicates to a sophisticated consumer of information in today's modern era. This isn't a serious thing. This is like, they're just kind of like jabbing at each other.
Mm. And so instead, if you did something, you know, you're driving in a car with a candidate.
Yeah.
Feels more, is that what you're saying?
Like, it's in your living room. It's in your car. It's somebody that you know that you could meet somewhere and have a 15, 20 second conversation without walking away and say, boy, that guy's kind of weird.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the basis of, I think, this entire shift from a generation of politicians that frankly were pretty weird, you know, but they're also very effective at doing what they needed to do to get elected. To now, I think, a generation where you're going to have some personality, you're going to have to have some authenticity. Core views clearly still play a big role, and there's always opposition research and things that play a huge role in shaping what those decisions are ultimately going to be for voters. But like, you know, it's a different matrix by which you value what it is you're trying to communicate today.
Josh, this has been great. Thank you for bringing all of your insights and your experience to our listeners here at The Odd Years. Really, really appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it. Good luck to everything. Loved your work for years.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.